Hello everyone, I hope you are well. I'm Carlos Carnicero Uravallen and I want to welcome you all to Future is Blue, a series of podcasts bringing together top experts from academia and think tanks to discuss the most pressing European economic and policy challenges of today. This is a Funcas Europe initiative and we hope we can bring new ideas for a more inspiring debate about Europe. Today we're here to talk about changes in the global geopolitical landscape and how Europe should respond to stay competitive in a new era. Funcas recently organized a webinar with leading members of the European Parliament working on economic affairs and high-profile policy officers from the European Commission. We are now continuing the conversation on this crucial topic with our guest contributor in today's podcast, and that is Sander Tordoir, who's senior economist at the Center for European Reform. Hello, Sander. Thank you for joining us. And Sander was invited to today's show, not only because he's a great analyst and he's joined us a few times now on this show, but also because he recently published a paper with other CER colleagues with the title Europe and the Superpowers, Responding to Economic Nationalism. So there's quite a lot in there, Sander. And based on that comprehensive paper, we're going to try to cover the key elements that are in there. And perhaps we could start this conversation with the following. So we've seen the different elements leading to the current changes that has provoked some kind of nationalist reaction in the US and China. And when you look at these changes, how has Europe responded differently compared to China and the US?
If you look at what's happening, on the one hand, you have the US, which is in many ways copying the Chinese model of economic development. So that includes very large spending on the industries of the future. Joe Biden signed his Inflation Reduction Act, which is estimated to spend, you know, up to $1 trillion or more dollars in the next 10 years on green tech. He put in place a CHIPS Act, and a number of other pieces of smaller legislation. And I think fundamentally what it does is it also biases against buying foreign, right? And so all these laws have the logic of basically building manufacturing capacity at home. And China has long been doing that, right? That's been the Chinese model, has been to build scale domestically with subsidies, with cheap credit from state-owned banks or state-backed banks, and then at some point to spring open the market and export. Now, Europe has basically seen this developing with some dismay. There have been a lot of diplomatic efforts to make tax credits in the US still accessible to European firms. But fundamentally, they have not followed that model. I think it's more of a halfway house. On paper, Europe has now a Net Zero Industry Act, which is the European Inflation Reduction Act. We have an EU CHIPS Act. And we've basically loosened curbs on state aid so member states can spend more on their industries. But across the board, these are weaker or less effective measures than what the US and China are doing. And maybe that's okay, because maybe on some level, Europe feels that it doesn't want to run as large deficits and to lavish as much money on the private sector as the others are doing. But I do think there's some holes in the architecture that are concerning. And so Europe will have to revisit, I think, this topic after the election in June.
What are you mentioned some holes. What are the key weaknesses that you've identified in Europe's response?
Well, essentially, Europe is a cash-strapped regulatory superpower, right? So the EU budget's 1% of EU GDP. Europe has a lot of, again, regulatory power because it's such a huge consumer market with 500 million consumers. And so you have this Brussels effect where basically across the European territory and beyond, Europe can set rules and standards. But 1% of EU GDP that's fully pre-programmed and there's a lot of vested interest. Just go to Brussels today and look at the farmers protesting. It's very hard to redirect some of that money to, say, chips or green tech. And so across the board, the pots of money are probably a little too small for what they're trying to achieve. The Net Zero Industry Act doesn't replicate the nationalism of the IRA, so it doesn't have hardcore built-in buy European clauses, which may be a good thing, right? That's quite a dirty way of doing it. But it also means that it will be hard for us to reach some of the objectives in terms of producing our own green tech at the same scale. And on the CHIPS Act, the same kind of problem. So it seems unlikely that we will be able to reach 20% of global market share in chips based on the current legislation.
All right, Sander, I like how you put it. A car, so it's a cash trap regulatory superpower. So there's definitely there are resources in Europe. It's quite a rich region where we are quite well off together, but probably we haven't set up the right priorities until now when money is in different little pots and we need to readjust. But moving on, I wanted to ask you about the World Trade Organization facing significant challenges in mediating global trade disputes and adjusting to the rise of economic nationalism. Now, in the paper, what viable paths do you see for reforming or adapting the WTO to a new era?
I think it will be very challenging. Essentially, the US has, despite still being the global hegemon in many areas and respect, has essentially turned against the WTO. The US administration even refuses to basically put in place certain personnel to make it work. And so you see that they basically think that the WTO is a device that China now uses to garner more power and economic prosperity. And they also feel, I think, certainly on the Democratic side, they feel like the WTO rules constrain their ability to do climate policy American style, which is not with carbon taxes, but by basically spending big and kind of again prioritizing their own firms. And so that logic means that for the WTO to keep somewhat of a level playing field is very difficult. I don't think that it will be reformed anytime soon, as long as the US is opposed to the extent that it is. But what I think the Europeans can do is we can try to keep basically markets open as much as possible, particularly for emerging and low income countries, which are, would be struggling the most probably if the global rule framework falls apart. But they're not actually competing so much in green tech and semiconductors, right? If you look at low carbon technology, roughly 80 to 90% of the market share is served by the US, China, Europe, Japan, and a few other advanced economies. And so I think having a sectoral approach as Europe and doing buy Europe the smart way, for example, by leveraging our carbon border adjustment mechanism and expanding it to not only include base materials like steel, but also electric vehicles, would be smart because it would be basically an environmental policy and not a economic policy. And then making sure that some of our partners, like, I don't know, just to mention a concrete example, India or Brazil or smaller economies are not affected as much. That type of approach is probably smarter than what we're doing now. What I find concerning in Europe is that we're completely unable to still close free trade agreements because of domestic political minorities basically that block it. So if you look at the Mercosur trade agreements with Latin American countries, that's a very useful instrument for us to be a bit less dependent on the US and China. And yet, anytime we get close to closing an FTA, which Europe used to be the best at in the world, in fact, we have the most free trade agreements of any major bloc, we now it basically gets stuck. And some parliament somewhere, some protest somewhere, kills the whole trade agreement for a smaller parochial interest. And I think strategically that harms us a lot.
So maybe I think we don't have the agility and the flexibility in our decision-making processes to react as fast as we need. I mean, maybe in the past it was fine to take a couple of decades to close an agreement, but in today's world with China, the dynamics in China and the US we're seeing today, we really cannot afford to have this, unanimity needs with the involvement of a number of parliaments, national parliaments to. I think the example of Mercosur is a great example. So
No,
is
exactly.
is
And
is a, so it's a, maybe you can comment on the lack of unity or the need to reform how we take decisions.
I mean, I'm certainly open to that, but if you think of trade, right, trade is a relatively centralized competence already. So trade deals are struck by the European Commission. So in fact, we don't have a major unanimity problem there. In the first stage, we then do have, ratification procedures and the like. I think you can play with those and tinker with those. I think more fundamentally, Europeans need to have a proper debate amongst themselves whether we think that a security standard in one agricultural product somewhere is sufficient reason to blow up an entire free trade agreement when we have this massive, massive economic problem that we're very dependent on trade. Like 40% of EU GDP is based on trade with the rest of the world, 40%. And we know that some of that, the two biggest economies in the world are no longer as reliable as they used to be. And then to me, I think we're basically not seeing the forest for the trees. And then maybe European politicians need to be more honest about what's actually at stake when we try to do a trade agreement with an India or Mercosur countries. And that debate hasn't taken place. And we still think that we can set these basically impossible standards for countries that are less developed, because we care about, things that also matter, like the environment. But I do think there are trade-offs here, and we're not being so honest about them.
Sander, in light of China's current economic strategy and its impact on global trade dynamics, how should Europe and the US adjust their policies to mitigate risks and capitalize on potential opportunities?
So my hunch is that what's super important for the Europeans is that we retain access as much as possible to American technology, because whether we like it or not, the US is the home of big tech firms, and China is also more of a, let's say, big scale innovator, right? They put a lot of money behind breakthrough innovation. That doesn't have to be a problem that we are not able to do that to the same extent. If you think of AI or AI chips, probably a lot of the innovation will come from the US and China. As long as we still have access to that technology and can disperse it throughout our economy, so essentially adopting the technology versus being the one to make it, I think we will be fine, and we can actually reap a lot of the productivity rewards, right? So if you're a small European firm with 10 people, and you have certain legal processes, for example, that you can make much more efficient with AI, then great, but you do need access to the AI. And so I think that will be a major priority, would be one for me. The other thing that the US and Europe could do is to basically try to give each other as much access to our various subsidy programs as possible. And so Alan Beatty of the FT and Brad Setzer of the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington have proposed a subsidies club of the EU, the US, Japan, and a few other countries that are like-minded democracies, where essentially we give each other access, that's the idea, give each other reciprocal access to our industrial policy. I think that's very smart. I think it's ambitious, but I think it's something worth striving for. And you could do something similar with computer chips. So if you think of Europe, we have in the Netherlands, but it's a wider supply chain. We have basically a global monopoly on chip making tools, on the machines to make chips. We have very high dependency on Taiwan and other places for the physical chips, and we rely on the US for the software and the sort of design of them. And so we each basically rely on the other. And so you could also have a chips club where you say, we're going to give each other access to our technology, even if geopolitical tensions rise or even if there's conflict. I think these kinds of approaches would be very, very useful to have debates on between Brussels and Washington.
So I understand there is more room for cooperation between Europe and the US than between Europe and Beijing and China, because those number of actions to create synergies are related to the fact that we are democracies on both sides of the Atlantic. And you, is that right?
I mean, that's my opinion. I think there are others who will disagree and say that it's totally feasible to work with China. I'm skeptical because, for one, we've seen that Dombrovskis repeated trips to China to try to address some of their overcapacities and basically the dumping of goods on global markets has not yielded any real results. Right. So he keeps going there. The language gets tougher. Even von der Leyen went, and nothing really fundamentally changes. In part, that's also because the Chinese domestic model relies on suppressing consumption and recycling savings into investment, which currently is being fully put into manufacturing and manufacturing exports. Now, that's because of the Chinese domestic model and domestic constraints. And so it's pretty hard for us, I think, to convince Beijing to take a different stance. Maybe they will, but it wouldn't be because of European diplomacy, I'd wager. In the US, of course, things are less friendly for Europeans than they used to be as well, but we do still have, I would say, allies there. There are still politicians that care about transatlantic relations. There's still a civil society that's open to. So if I were a betting man, I would bet that you can achieve more with the US than you can with China.
Sander, one final question for you. How do you assess the feasibility and potential impact of the EU's green industrial strategy in the context of global competition, especially with the US and China aggressively subsidizing their industries?
My overall take and our research suggests that Europe is stronger in green tech than people think. So if you divide the world into EU, China, US, and you look at global market share of green tech, we discussed this before, Carlos. Actually, Europe is far ahead of the US, I think, in part because we've cared more about the environment and climate change than our American friends. And so we've done a lot more in terms of, again, putting regulation in place more than money. And that's yielded real results and innovation in the European market. The other thing to remember is that trading green goods or any good across long distances is very expensive. The UK is now finding that trading with New Zealand and Australia is all fine, but it doesn't yield nearly as much as trading with France, which is next door. And so that fundamental logic, that rule of gravity in trade, is asserting itself in green markets. So Europe has a lot of strengths to build on, essentially. We don't maybe need to spend as much as the US is doing, who have, well, ca some catching up to do. And we don't need to spend as much as China is doing because that's their imbalanced economic model. And so some of this subsidy race will end in tears, and much of the money or a portion will be wasted, even in the US and China. And so we can avoid some of these mistakes. But what I think is deeply dangerous for European cohesion is that we've now, at least until 2025, we've agreed on letting countries do it themselves. So Germany is pursuing its own subsidies, France is pursuing its own subsidies, and everybody else. And it's very hard to reconcile that with a deeply integrated European market. It could distort supply chains. It could put certain businesses out of the market that are actually viable and maybe the most innovative. And so my preference would be that a new European Commission would make another push for a much more coherent European industrial policy, maybe with European money, or at the very least, deeply sort of standardized and making sure that we don't have these divergences at home. Because if you look at the European market and trade goods trade in the EU, it has actually grown a lot more than our goods trade with the rest of the world. And so our single market's already a source of resilience and an insurance mechanism in a way against trade nationalism elsewhere. And so destroying the single market because you're worried about the US and
Yeah.
China is very self-defeating.
In the webinar in the European Parliament, one of the participants, Jonas Fernandez, who's a member of the European Parliament, he was saying, the single market is Europe's most important asset when it comes to strategic autonomy. And in fact, he was pointing out to these elements that are quite a threat to the single market if you allow member states to inject money into the local businesses. Individually, you create a number of problems that are not going to help in the end for the goal of that we are discussing today of Europe becoming stronger in this competitive landscape. So anyway, I'm sure, Sander, this is not the last time we're going to be covering this subject. It's quite a broad topic, but you brought us so many good insights. And let me remind everyone that there's a paper from the Center for European Reform that is Europe and the Superpowers Responding to Economic Nationalism, and I'm going to include the link to the paper in the show notes. And I'd like to thank Sander Tordoir, who's Senior Economist at the Center for European Reform, for joining us today. Thank you, Sander.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you all for joining. This was all for now. We will come back soon with more exciting speakers on Europe's economic and policy-related key debates. Future is Blue is a Funcas Europe initiative. I'm Carlos Carnicero Urabayen, and if you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to recommend it to others and share it on social media. Thank you all, and stay well.